Sherman Patterson, who is the Mayor Ryback's policy aide for public safety and civil rights, too, correct? Sherman's been on the beat for several years. I first met him about 6 years ago at a state convention in Rochester and was immediately impressed and felt, well, suddenly much more comfortable walking the streets at night knowing that he was on the beat. He's very, very thoughtful, and I'm thrilled to death that 6 years later he's still with us here in the city of Minneapolis. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to him. Please enjoy your coffee, and then at the end of the session, we'll probably have a few announcements to make as well. So with that, I'd like to give the mic to Sherman. Give him a hand, please.
Can everybody hear me okay? Good morning, first of all. Thanks for having me. I'm not Mayor Ryback, but I'm Sherman. Just want to tell you a little bit about myself, but I want to recognize Senator. I see Senator Disick, Councilmember Hofstede, and Representative Kahn, but most of all of you guys are here. When Jeremy called me a few weeks ago, I think it was about a few weeks ago, about coming over here to talk, I said without a doubt, I said, of course. With everything going on with gun violence reduction, and he asked me about youth violence. But let me tell you a little bit about myself first. I am a 21-year retired U.S. Army active duty military. I've been retired a little over 10 years now. I've been with Mayor Ryback going on, I believe it's 8 years. You all can hear me, right? I am his public safety policy aide, and I'm the guy that calls the mayor late at night, early in the morning when we have a violent crime or per se a homicide that's usually a shooting death. Also, as Jeremy said, I'm his liaison for civil rights and many other things. And I'm also I'm active in the community. I live in North Minneapolis. My wife she's from North Minneapolis. She's a Metropolitan all her life. I'm from Savannah, Georgia, and I called home yesterday. My mom said it's 80 degrees and sitting on the front porch. So I'll jump right into this. As you can see, I have a beard. And this beard and my hair is going to grow. I've made a commitment that I'm not going to cut my hair or shave until Congress takes a vote on gun legislation. So when Jeremy asked me to come and talk in reference to youth violence, I'll start off with youth violence first. He said you asked some questions about youth violence. Several years ago in 2006, when I joined the mayor, we had a rash of violence with youth between the ages of 15 and 24. When I came on board in March of 2006, I was calling, giving the mayor a call about three times a week. Young men were shooting and killing each other, and something had to be done. On July 4th of 2006, I believe, 2006, a young man, Brian Cole, was shot and killed. He was mistakenly shot and killed by another gang, by a gang member who thought he was someone else. Brian was a young man who was doing well in school. He was academically sound. He was a good kid, very well known, and he had a scholarship. He was heading off to college that summer. But after Juneteenth, he was just out sitting, as we all have the right to do, to sit down. He was outside sitting on Penn Avenue, I believe it was Penn Avenue, and a drive-by shooting came and he was shot and killed. Informed the mayor, we went to his parents' house, two solid parents who we sat down and talked, and I saw the passion that came from the mayor to them with myself, and I knew the parents, but I also knew Brian. And to lose a child, not to see a child, your child grow up and go to college is something that I just can't even fathom. Because I have two kids. I have a 31-year-old and a 21-year-old, and my 21-year-old is just enlisted in the United States Army. Whoa. Oh, you don't get the whoa thing, that's military. So in saying that, too many times that I have called the mayor, I've been to homicide scenes where I've seen young men laying out on the street. So this is where the Youth Violence Blueprint for Action Plan came into place. We sat down with the philanthropic community, faith-based, corporate America, and of course the community to design this plan to how can we stop this problem. And through the years, we've continued building through the youth violence where we've taken it, the violence has gone down and down and down. I believe it's decreased the last stats, I believe it's 59%. That's huge. From 2006 to today, now you rarely hear about youth violence. Yes, there are some pockets of things that we hear and we see, but it's not even comparable from today to where we were in 2006. Whereas almost every other day or evening, you were reading or hearing in the news about a young person shooting or hurting each other. And this was happening in the communities of color. Young African American men, they were, the elephant in the city was they were killing each other, shooting and killing each other. And the mayor would ask me, Sherm, who's arming our kids and where are the guns coming from? So what I'm telling you is that the connection of guns and youth violence had a big connection with the Richfield, when they broke into the Richfield gun shop, with gun trafficking, and et cetera, et cetera. And I'll stop if there are any questions. No, I can keep going. I just. So recently, I'm going to segue. As with the youth, we came up with the blueprint for action plan, and I want to read off four things for you. The goals were connect youth to a trusted adult, intervene at the first sign of risk, restore youth that have gone down the wrong path, and unlearn the culture of violence. And I think the fourth one is so true. Violence is a learned behavior. Violence is a learned behavior. A child does not come out the womb or come out of the house saying, I'm going to be violent. This is taught. This is an environment. And so one of our goals is very important, is to unlearn that culture. And that's through education, that's through economic development, and that's through just teaching, just being nice to one another. Because to pick up a book instead of picking up a gun, to smile, how many times you go out and you're not seeing children smiling? I remember when I was growing up, people were always smiling. And when you smile at somebody, that's just, you're drawn to that. But if you're not, then what's wrong? If you see a kid walking down the street or you see a kid just really not smiling at you, then I'm wondering, what's going on? Are you hungry? Is something going on in the house? What's happening? And we've identified that, and that's, the mayor has been a stickler on this with our partners, from the school systems to the community, as I said, the philanthropic community, just a broad base. It's like a good cancer that metastasizes out. So when you spread that out and you're touching these kids, they're happy. They're doing positive things. And that's from the Youth Congress and just a whole plethora of things. So in saying that, my main area, as you can tell, is public safety. So when the gun issue came up, as the gun concerns, we had Newtown, we had Aurora, of course we had in our own backyard accent signage. But as Chief Flynn from Milwaukee said, we have a slow motion massacre that happens in our country every day in our cities. And that's with young people who are obtaining guns and killing each other on the street. And that's something that there's a reality about that. Young people are killing each other. And how are they getting these guns? That's the question. How are they getting these guns? They just don't walk into these communities. And then we need strong gun legislation. As you can see, there's a big battle going on right now about, some people are saying about Second Amendment rights, taking away our Second Amendment rights. This is not about taking away anyone's Second Amendment rights. This is about responsible gun ownership. Responsible gun ownership. The preacher, I'm trying to remember his name. Right now, his son just committed suicide. He had a big bout of depression, and he bought the gun on the internet without a background check. Without a background check. We have to have universal background checks. Because 40% of people are going out here and they're obtaining guns. If I went through TSA, 60% of you are going to be checked, 40% of you are not going to be checked. Are you getting on that plane? Think about it. If you knew 40% of the people on the plane weren't going to be checked to see if they're safe or not, are you interested in getting on that plane? It's just smart. It's the right thing to do. When will the next accident happen? When will the next Newtown happen? When will the next homicide on the street happen? I am not the bearer of bad news, but I am the bearer of reality. And I've seen it so much myself. I saw a 12-year-old shoot the ice cream man on my street. And this happened several years ago. I was on my porch reading a book, and a 12-year-old robbed and shot the ice cream man. My God, where did a 12-year-old get a gun from? I've seen young people I've known come to my house and said, Sherm, we want to talk. When I would tell them, put your guns, where are your guns at? Truce. Put them down and let's talk. They want to live, they want to have a life, they want to move forward. These young people want to move forward, but they're scared. But they see having a gun as protection, having a gun as I'm a man, but that's not true. Having a gun doesn't make you a man. But I'm wondering in the back of my mind, where are you getting these guns from? It's been generational and generational and generational. So what I want to move to right now is about the from the congressional piece of this is we had a Midwest Gun Summit, regional gun summit here in January. I did over a year's worth of research on this, traveling to different cities from New York to Philadelphia to Milwaukee to Chicago and even out west to California. And we partnered with the city of Milwaukee to address the gun issue. We brought about 85 people to this gun summit. We had elected officials, we had law enforcement, we had philanthropics. I mean, it was just really good to come down and strategize about how can we address this problem from a Midwestern viewpoint. Because we know it's a national viewpoint, but it's also from a Midwestern outlook of it. And Mayor Ryback and Mayor Barrett from Milwaukee led this charge, and we had some very good conversations, with the U.S. Attorney, with our state leaders, with our city leaders, and also with some people from the community. And we're looking for some very good outcomes on that. The summary is coming out from the Gun Summit, which helped lead to President Obama coming down to Minneapolis and North Minneapolis to see, recognizing the work that we are doing. And we are leading. Minneapolis is, Minneapolis and Minnesota, we are leading on this here. We are at the forefront on this. But what we have to do is, right now, is we have to get the votes in, and we have to contact our people in Washington and say we have to have responsible gun legislation. So on that note, I know I kind of condensed all of that together. I kind of want to listen to you and take questions, and I hope I've been a little informative. Yes, sir.
Can I pass the mic around? So
yes, sir. I can get more.
Can you say who you are?
Don Ostrom. Could you tell us how the guns are obtained by the youth? Are they buying them directly? Are they buying them in the suburbs? Are they stealing them? Are they getting them from home like the Newton shooter?
One of they're obtaining them in Minnesota and Minneapolis. They are stealing them, okay? They are stealing them. They are being brought into the communities, both of what you said, they're being trafficked in. But with the young people, for instance, the Richfield gun shop, they're stealing them out of homes. They're stealing them out of gun shops. They're, robbing people. And also, they are being trafficked in. They're brought into the community by others. Yes, sir, to answer your question.
How do you break the cycle then?
Well, by breaking the cycle is by having stronger laws. We have to have consequences. Right now, if a person says, I lost or I stole my gun, or my gun was stolen, there isn't a penalty for that. If I went and bought 10 guns from a gun shop, and I came out and sold them, and they were tracking this here, and they said, "Well, you bought 10 guns, and this gun was used in a shooting. We found out that this gun was used in a shooting. Well, that gun, my gun was stolen. Why didn't you report it? Why didn't know it was missing? We have to have a tracking system from that. You know, sometimes what it is usually people, when guns are stolen, if you have guns stolen and the same person is having this gun lost or stolen, a light goes on in your head, right? So there should be some consequences from that. Right now, we don't have any. Right now, we don't have any.
At this moment, since some of the issues of gun laws have come up, do you mind if we introduce a couple of other folks? We can still converse with Sherman, but we have a couple of relevant additions this morning. Laura Taken is over here, and she's a committee aide in the House on this very subject. And then Carrie Dedzic, our senator for Senate District 60 this year, has wanted to make a comment on a current Senate bill. And then we can take the conversation back to questions with Sherman. Just give us a second. Pardon? Oh, Senator, here you go.
Morning. Thank you. I'm pretty sure in the Senate bill, we have two gun bills in the Senate, and I sit on the Judiciary Committee, and we did this about a month ago, so I don't have all the details, but the situation where he just talked about where the gun buyers will say, my gun was stolen. If we are able to figure out, because usually the police can tell if it was stolen, when it was stolen, or if it was actually truly lost. So if they do a false reporting now, that is now a crime. So there's two Senate bills. One of them, actually, we are, it passed out of committee. So that's good. It's still, I don't know if it passed out. You know, they have other issues in the House. But in our Senate bill, we have two of them, and one of them will actually improve the background check system. And then the other bill has a bunch of the other stuff that he's talking about. So we are, we're hopeful, and we're working on the Senate side.
And Senator Dedzic, one bill is 489. I think that's the Senate bill. And then the House bill is, if I have it right, is one is 285. So I know there's a lot going on up at the Capitol right now in reference to this. Yes?
Hi. Phyllis Kahn, and I'm not on the committees that deal with the House bills, so I'm just kind of watching it from advance and giving Michael Paymar as much support as he can possibly have. But I either read on a blog or read in the New York Times or something, there was some city, all of these facts are a little, well, I think it was Baltimore, where they did a very strong laws, rules, ordinances, whatever, that anyone doing anything that violates any gun law with a gun goes to jail. And their homicide rate went down dramatically. No plea bargaining. You're carrying without a permit or anything like that. I don't know what those penalties are here. But people went right to jail, and their list names went into a registry and so forth. And the homicide rate in that city went down totally dramatically. And I wondered if there's anything we can do now. And specifically, is there anything we can do if the state, which... Carrie may have, the Senate's been a lot better than the House, so Carrie may have more confidence than I do about good stuff happening. But is there anything the city can specifically do on its own? And I think that thing that I mentioned, I believe, was a city ordinance.
Bottom line is that the city cannot preempt the state law. And there's no, we... Well, that will be, we would have to look at that with our city and county attorneys from that standpoint. And we are looking at a lot of things. We're working also with our federal partners on, we had Project Exile, and Project Exile is if you're a convicted felon, you can't have a gun. And if you're caught with a per se gun, you get the maximum penalty on that. But there's just so many layers with that, Phyllis, that when you're talking about exercising more punishment. That's just from a county, city, and a standpoint as far as with the lawyers, and that's where they're going to.
I can comment to that question a little bit if that's helpful. There was a bill introduced by Representative Dean, I don't recall the number offhand, that may be worked on over the interim and brought forward next year. He wasn't quite ready to present it this year, but there is a bill about allowing local communities more say in their gun laws. And I'm not sure if that made it, was it in the Senate bill? Okay. So That's out there, yeah.
And I just want to say, if you follow in the media that just recently Connecticut, Maryland, and also Colorado, the governors have signed off on stronger gun legislation, and it's really, as I said, it's a movement that's going on.
Well, my name is Malcolm, and I don't have as much a question as a comment, because I think we're putting the cart before the horse, because I think we need to start looking at family. This little structure seems to have gone by the wayside. I come from a communal type of family. I have 600 family members, and I know them all. This gives me the social support in dealing with stuff. But when you've got kids that are dealing with technology, we've got veterans who are dealing with PTSD, there's a whole lot of things that are preventing people from communicating in a safe and sane way. And I think another thing that isn't being addressed is how law enforcement reacts to military that is suffering from PTSD, because the history has been shoot the puppy and then we'll deal with it. But I mean, you know, this is somebody who suffered, is reacting. I've got clients who have PTSD. I've seen them react. They're not very safe when they're reacting. But nobody ever does anything about setting up protocols. So even law enforcement is guilty of killing because they don't have the protocols in place. But there's an awful lot of things that need to be done. I understand the reaction to something that's happening, but we have to plan long range in getting things done. And I think family is where it's at.
Well, you may.
Yes, ma'am. Just to be a little more informative, and Hennepin County does have a veterans court that's going on, and also that's in the work of Minneapolis is becoming a yellow ribbon city, and so that's happening also. We have been meeting with, I myself am on that committee with Lieutenant Colonel, Deputy Chief Eddie Frizzell, who's in the Minneapolis Police Department, along with others within the city of Minneapolis on becoming a yellow ribbon city, partnering with the National Guard for our veterans. So, yes, sir.
What does a yellow ribbon city?
It's that a yellow ribbon city. No, you just had to say that, didn't you, Jerry? No, yellow. What is it? We're in support with the state of Minnesota in reference to helping our veterans, being there for our veterans, partnering with them and directing them to resources, and also resources that are available within the city and the county of City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County, and throughout Minnesota. So that's what's happening there.
And then we have one here. And can you say your name?
Hi, I'm Diane Hofstad, City Council member. And just to say, the legislation that Representative Dean and Carrie and Phyllis are supporting or sponsoring are initiatives that the city is moving forward. We have a very robust anti-violence, anti-gun legislative package that both at the state and federal level. And we have been partners with our legislatures in that regard. But just to say that in addition to that, we recover about 40% of the guns in the city of Minneapolis from the north side. And we have a very robust program to identify and to move forward to try to eliminate as many guns as we can in our city. Sometimes when you see or hear that we are pulling over people in cars, Many times the stops are because there are other reasons besides a traffic stop that an individual may be pulled over, and oftentimes we find guns and drugs in the cars. So when you see a traffic officer pulling somebody over, be grateful, because they may be taking off, taking out away from our community some violent equipment that we don't want to have there.
Sure, I've done a lot of work on the north side through the years, and this issue is layered. It's family, it's PTSD, it's having guns. I don't want to see us react, just trigger, and say, okay, take the guns away, you take the issue away. You don't. It would be nice. Ruth Usum. Sherm, what is it that Minneapolis is doing that puts us on the map as the number one successful story here?
I think we're doing a number of things. Especially, it starts with our youth. We understand that we're in the limelight, as you want to say, we're a bright star. Is that we are so laser focused on addressing this problem, not by being reactive, by being proactive, and by being preventative, and having intervention. If you can prevent something, you wouldn't have to intervene in it. And so what we're doing is, as I said, with our youth, I'll just go from an enforcement standpoint. I'll start with that first, okay? We are really looking at the hot spots in the city as far as we're looking at gun violence. The new chief, Chief Harto, she's getting officers out on the streets, walking, knocking on doors, how are you doing, interacting with the community, not reacting, but interacting. So this has helped us a lot in reference to as far as becoming a part of the community. Our school resource officers have been a big success, because the officers are talking to the kids in the schools, and they're finding out things that are happening of negative behavior, but at the same time, they're establishing those relationships with the kids. I bite cops for kids, and if you saw when the president came, Officer Mike Kirchen was sitting right next to the president, and this has been a huge success. Parenting, our health department, we've been from the Youth Violence Blueprint for Action Plan has just been a stickler in this here. Our youth Congress, the mayor has been beating the streets. Councilmember Diane Hallstatt has been, her and the city council members have all, we've taken a really, they've really taken on this issue in reference to gun violence and youth violence in the city of Minneapolis, that we are directing resources towards being preventive and intervening at the first site of violence and changing the culture. The bottom line is what we're doing is we are changing the culture of violence in our city, and we are leading that. And ma'am, and as I said, if I just keep going, we can go on and on and on with our health, from my health department, from the police department, from the mayor's office, from city council, from partnering with our faith base in the community, to our philanthropical community. It's just so many programs that are out there. I would have to get real way down in the weeds on it. And I know Jeremy told me I can talk to you, just give you some things offline, because Jeremy told me I had a certain amount of time, and I'll get the other people.
I'm gonna.
Did you have
yours,
or did it get addressed?
Yeah. No, I'm gonna add one other. I can add one other specific to that too. That it's helping change the culture. On the north side, Minneapolis got a huge grant, and maybe Councilmember Hofstad remembers how much, but it's in the like $25 million to literally start and focus on the family from the minute that child is born, and doing a lot of pre-K work, and so it helps get them. I mean, if you can get them interested in school and get the parents interested in school and get a lot of these young parents interested in knowing how important school is, that is helping to change the culture. And so they are partnering on that $25 million. They're partnering, as Sherm said, with the faith-based communities. Hennepin County Social Services is involved in that, to helping identify families that need help. They're also working on chemical and mental health issues to literally address some of those specific family needs. And I mean, it's literally doing it one family at a time. So
one of our biggest partners, And I think this will really hit home for you, is Northside Achievement Zone. We're taking it. That has been our biggest, that's what it's all about. We're taking so many blocks, and we're teaching families how to be families, okay? We're teaching families how to be families. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, can you hold in? I have here and here, and then I'll come over there. And then I'll come to you.
Thanks, Aviva Breen. I think everything and anything probably has to be tried. I think, though, too, sometimes I don't contact my congressional members because I assume that they are on the same page as I am, and I think we can't assume that everybody is really strong on a lot of issues relating to guns and relating to the proposals in Congress, just based on responses that some of friends of mine have received to letters they've sent. And so I would say if you know for sure where they stand, then send a letter and say thank you and keep on being strong, because they also need that. And the other is, you know, say what it is we think should be done. For me, it's background checks number one. But there are, you know, I have a priority list of my own, and I would express that, and they don't have to have the same one, but I want to be sure that they are strong and out there and not doing anything or not saying anything or waiting to see what happens, because that isn't what we elected them for.
I want to share something with you that I think it'll hit home to everyone. On December 26th of 2012, I was with my wife. My wife and I were at a movie. We were seeing a show at the movie theater, and I got notified. I looked at my phone and I said, "Oh my gosh!" I got notified that a 3-year-old had been shot in the head. And I was probably one of the first to know about it. So I had to. So I checked. I said, "Is this Sherm? Is this right?" So I made a call to MPD, and they said, "Yes, Sherm. Terrell Mays is headed to the hospital." So immediately, my wife saw that look. She knows that look when I get that look on my face, and she said, "Go back." She just said, "Go outside and make your call." So I made the call. I mean, I've seen a lot personally in my life, you know, being in the military, things on the north side and other places, south side. But that sent shivers through me when I heard that a 3-year-old had been shot in the head. So I called the mayor, and probably for one of the first times, he had gotten quiet on the phone. I mean, he really got quiet. Then he said, "Sherm, should I come?" He said, "Well, he was coming. It's just his mind was gone." He said, "Should I come now?" I said, "Hold up. I'm headed to the hospital." So I went to the hospital. And when I walked in there and met the mother and the father, gave them a hug, we went into the room, and I saw this beautiful child, like, laying up there like he was sleeping with a big Band-Aid around his head. I mean, he was just like, if I saw Angel, I saw Angel. He was just laying up there, just sleeping, but with the Band-Aid around his head and the tube going through his nose. And then from there, the mayor came and we talked to his family and so forth. The next morning, I told Marsha, "Well, I'll call you and check on you to see how he's doing." And I called early that morning and I said, "Marsha, how's Terrell doing?" She says, "We just took him off life support." I had that cold feeling again. And all I could think about was why? And here we go, here we're going again. Where did the gun come? Who's arming our kids? We still haven't solved that homicide. And that's something, and that could have been prevented. That's what I'm saying, that could have been prevented. And this is why we have to have strong gun legislation. This is why everyone in this room has to write letters to call your congressmen, your senators, and say, "You know what, this has to stop." Because it could have easily been my child, your child, me, you. You never know. You never know. Look at Newtown. People, that doesn't happen in Newtown, but yes, it did. That doesn't happen in the movie theater. Yes, it did. That doesn't happen to accent signage. Yes, it did. And John Souter is a good friend of mine, the last survivor of accent shooting. And when I sit down at John at dinner and I just watch him, just the pain, but also the passion in him about, Sherm, we've got to do something. He says, something has to be done. And it has to be done now. Why are we debating this issue? There shouldn't even be a debate. There shouldn't even be a debate. Our babies are dying. People are dying. Our friends are dying. And let's talk about the people who've been shot who aren't dead. The scars. A lot of dead, they're dead inside. Think about the John Souters. Think about Marsha Mays, a parent. Think about someone who you know who may have been shot, or you know of someone that may have, that knows somebody that has been shot, has been affected. Think about the 18,000 people who commit suicide a year. There are more people, I believe I'm correct, more people commit suicide a year than those who are killed by homicide. We don't even talk about that. We don't even talk about that. So that's why the mayor is passionate. We're also along with Mayors Against Illegal Guns. We work with closely with Mayor Bloomberg's office. I'm the regional coordinator for that. And we are so serious about this. We are inundated in this area. I live this here. When the mayor sees me, I'm calling him again. It's plastered across my head. Where did the gun come from and who's arming our kids? Yes, ma'am.
Sherm, Betty Folliard, nice to see you. A couple things. First of all, I want to acknowledge the elected officials in the room right now, because the folks like Phyllis, like Diane, like Carrie, etc., when they deal with these issues, they get hate mail and they get death threats. And so when you talk about, well, should we be writing our folks because they agree with us? Yes. Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. You know, they need to hear the positive here. The other thing is that, well, there was a point in my life when I was a school board member and I walked up the barrel of a gun to take off a gun behind North Junior High School in Hopkins from an eighth grader who was pointing it at me and my son. And so this stuff is very close to me, but you also touch something to my heart, because I'm a Blue Star mom, and I've got my son who is a captain in the Army in Iraq right now, and a daughter-in-law who is a captain in the Army in Korea right now. And you talk about the Yellow Ribbon program, which you are connected to, but one of the things that I find is a problem there is that although our child came from Minnesota, and his records say he's from Minnesota, he spent time in Hawaii and then in Colorado, and when these two get back together again from opposite parts of the world, they'll end up in Alaska. Does Alaska have the Yellow Ribbon program? Because, you know, it's his second tour in Iraq, and the first tour he came back in pretty bad shape. You know, will they have those kind of resources to help them kind of re-enter after being in war zones, et cetera?
We're meeting the Yellow Ribbon. I'm glad we're meeting on the 17th of this month. So that question that you, I'm taking that back. Yes, ma'am, and I'll give you my card, because I'm going to ask. Have an answer for you in reference to Alaska, because it's an umbilical cord. Yeah. It should be an umbilical cord, and we should be, and that's how I'm looking at it right now.
I think we had this one waiting, and then Malcolm second. And then you, Randy.
I'm Stuart Hansen. I come from the health field, physician, and so looking at this as a public health problem. And in a public health problem, we say the best principle is to focus on the product. So we're focusing on guns, because that's the product here. What this discussion has all been about the victims or the perpetrators, but you haven't discussed the sellers. And the sellers are, that's the opposition. They're very anxious to keep this going because they make money out of it. So what are they? Public issues and the public policy issues that we can do to constrict the sellers to be more responsible.
Sure.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me now? Is that Mr. Hofstede back there who can't hear me? Thanks for asking that. I was waiting for that question to come in reference to the sellers. The sellers and the opposites. That's a very, very right now sensitive and touchy topic, which has gone on about is the sellers, and that's all that starts from the manufacturers to gun dealers to private sellers, and what's happening now where we're pushing for universal background checks. You just recently seen the Tomei and Mancini. Have you been following? The Tomei and Mancini in Congress have come up with a bill that requires background checks, and with their proposal, it's stronger background checks in reference to going to gun shows, and also over the we're holding the internet. A person has to do a background check for over the internet now. It would if that passes, if you're buying a gun over the internet, you have to do a background check. That's not happening now. I think I'm addressing your question. Also, it will require all dealers at gun shows to do background checks if they're advertising. Now, for family members, if you and I are family members, that would exclude a family member to a family member. If I sold my gun to you, I wouldn't have to do a background check. So it wouldn't be called universal background checks. It's called background checks. Also, sir, in addressing the we from Mayors Against Illegal Guns, and you can go to the website. I mean, it's a plethora of information there in reference to gun sellers, private dealers, the gun show loophole. We are addressing the sellers and purchasers, and with the battle between what's going on right now between the opposition, those opponents who are against stronger gun laws, from the NRA, you know, what's been going on with the NRA, all over the news, other gun organizations, and let me be clear. I just want to really say this. You can see I'm really thinking about this. Is that the biggest issue is the Second Amendment, the infringement of the Second Amendment rights that's being pushed, and that's not the case. And this is what it's being pushed to the media that they're going to they're infringing our Second Amendment rights. But 90% of Americans. People, 90% of people believe we should have stronger gun legislation. Even those, I believe it's over 70% in the NRA are saying the same thing. The NRA members are saying the same thing. We agree with you. The American people agree that we should have stronger gun legislations and gun legislation. So I think I answered your question. If you need me to go more in depth, I can.
What are the other public policy things, like taxing it 100% tax on sales or something like that?
That's now you get into a policy piece I'm going to bring up. legislative.
Yeah, so my name's Kira Dietzick. I'm the state senator from Senate District 60, and Mr. Hansen asked about other public policy ideas to stop guns, and one of them was taxing guns, and that was discussed in a sub-caucus in the tax committee. I'm also on the tax committee, and that was discussed, but it's literally picking our battles right now. So in the Judiciary Committee, we are taking in this blueprint for violence actually was taking and looking at gun violence from a public health standpoint. And so they are looking at many different levels that way. From the policy standpoint, so we have discussed that. Again, we're picking our battles because we figure if we throw that in the mix right now, that will create more angst in the tax bill. And then it also will create more angst, and we believe, at least in the Senate side, that we are getting traction on. We separated the bills, and so we believe we are getting some traction on some of the portions of these bills. Depending on how you ask the question, 70 to 90% of NRA members believe that and are okay with background checks. So, and so there is support there. There was another, and I believe it starts some, you know, it gets again into public policy. A lot of the biggest purchasers of ammunition are local government units and states. And so, the mayors for... Mayors Against Illegal Guns, they've been actually talking to gun manufacturers, and I think they did take a large blowback, but I think it's a good idea because, again, so our tax dollars are being used to buy a product to, you know, for protect public safety, and then they're turning around, and they're part of NRA that are turning around and you know, so it's just a vicious circle. And so I think they're doing a great job trying to, you know, educate the manufacturers of saying, you know, look, we'll take our business elsewhere. So that is just, you know, another little way to kind of tighten it. So we're having those discussions. It's sometimes we're just picking our battles.
My name's Laura Taken-Holtze. I'm the committee administrator on the House side, and I'll touch on a couple things. One of them, the NRA, and second, I realized I didn't talk about the status of legislation in the House. First of all, with regards to the opposition, we did a week of gun hearings, and the NRA is, as you know, incredibly organized. Those hearings were packed with NRA members, all carrying. It was a little terrifying at points. And so part of it is, you know, it seems like common sense to all of us. We need to get involved. We need to come to those hearings. Because otherwise what legislators see is only the other side, all the public comments, only the other side. And what's a real struggle is for our rural members. And that is really, frankly, what's holding things up is because they vote for gun legislation, the NRA goes after them. And they aren't necessarily getting the letters saying, we want you to vote for greater gun control. A big fear on their side is the Second Amendment rights. They fear that universal background checks will ultimately lead to a gun registry, which ultimately will lead to confiscation of their weapons, of their guns. It's a slippery slope argument. There are many stops before we get to confiscation of guns. And just like regulating child porn has not stopped our First Amendment, universal background checks will not stop, lead to confiscation. The other thing I want to just explain is I realized I didn't talk about the status of legislation in the House. Representative Paymar, the chair of the Public Safety Committee, put together an omnibus gun bill that had a lot of similar provisions to the Senate, and it was fairly strong. It didn't make it out of committee. Instead, what made it out of committee was Representative Lesch's bill, which was called the Prosecutor's Package. Now, there are some good things in there. It adds ammunition to a number of laws regarding illegal guns, which means what's been happening is, like he was saying, people will be pulled over, they'll throw the gun out the window, but they'll have pockets of ammunition. Well, this gives law enforcement tools to still go after that. So the status of it is that has gone through and the gun show loophole has gone through. Not universal background checks, not internet sales, but the gun show loophole, which I know seems ridiculous. However, it's a step. Frankly, the hope is when we get into conference committee, we can have the Senate take over a little bit more of that. My advice would be if you have relatives in rural areas, contact them. Ask them to contact their representative. That would be a huge help because, you know, in the urban areas, it's all common sense to us. Help our rural members see. Thanks.
You know, oh, I'm sorry. Duck, when you say duck in Minneapolis and duck in the rural areas, you know, they're hunting. It's two different things. If you go down, you go some places in the city, and you say, and the word duck is mentioned, they're ducking. Okay? They are literally ducking. Now, you go out in rural Minnesota, say duck, quack, quack, bam. I mean, I think everyone gets that, just as you articulated there. And this is where we have to come to common ground. But
Phyllis Kahn again. I just want to say something about the political realities which are getting there. NRA put a pile of money into Senate races this year, supported 8 candidates, 7 of their highest NRA supported candidates lost. There's, for the first time, there's now some, I heard this on NPR, there's some place, something that's forming to be a counterbalance to the NRA. And I just, you know, I think that that has to be encouraged. I'm glad you mentioned the relative issue. I tell that to everyone who comes to my office. Relatives, coworkers, friends, you know, certainly get to talking to them. But this idea of going after ammunition, the idea of tracing, you know, you can trace a car. If it leaves a piece of paint on another car, you can go back and trace what that car is. How about some more work on the tracing of bullets and seeing where they are? And
okay, Jeremy's telling me that, yeah. Recognizing Randy.
Okay. Yeah, a couple of things. Even before Sandy Hook, I was watching October 2nd, 2012, Amy Goodman, you can download it, gave a tour of Virginia Tech. And that was, so you can get a thrust as to they were white, there would be more like Sandy Hook, you know. And I just want to, you know, our representative, Keith Ellison, when I mentioned Gabby to him, there were kind of tears in his eyes. You could just tell it hit him. And one thing I would like to see happen, maybe bring Gabby here with Senator Ellison, and she's still alive. She can still speak, and that's wonderful. And yeah, watch Amy Goodman, the other things too, but October 2nd, 2012, just before the big debate with, okay.
Okay, excellent, thank you.
Hi, Tony Hofstad. I just have a question. First of all, I'd like to thank Piers Morgan on CNN because he's kept this whole dialogue alive. But the other thing is, you know, it looks like the Senate is going to have an up and down vote on the gun legislation, federal, which is so important. And we know where our senators, I think, stand, but it's really the Democratic senators that are creating somewhat of the problem because of the fear they have, like in Virginia, where the NRA, again, is so strong. And maybe we can do something with our own senators to have them lobby, you know, other senators in the mix to find out if that's possible. I don't know what you know about that, Sharon, but it's just a major issue, and it has to start at the federal issue. I understand all the things that we're doing here, and those are great, but the federal is really what's going to dictate, I think, what happens into the states.
And as long as I'm back here, can I go to Malcolm, and then you can?
Well, I think from the conversation, you're finding out that changing policy is very ineffective if you're doing it externally. There's special interest groups that use semantics to alter the course of the conversation. So it's like in Minneapolis, bringing this home here, the Minneapolis police force is the most innocent police force in the nation because no policeman has ever been found guilty of their egregious action. And for the first time in my advocacy, I was able to actually speak Indian speak. Usually I have to speak white speak in order to get my message across. But since the chief of police is Native, we share some norms in common. So I was able to express to her that the only time that any effective change can be made in the Minneapolis Police Force is if it's done internally, meaning it has to start with her. And she assured me that that will happen. So I'm thankful for that. But I think you're going to find that any time you try to do anything externally, it's doomed to fail. That's why we have to get into a society of consensus.
Reply to Mr. Halstead's question first. And Tony, yes, so we are working, we're getting letters, we're getting them to our congressionals at the federal level, working on that every day of getting people to send in letters to in support of this gun legislation. And we need letters from you all. And I'll give you my cards if you want to send in letters of support that we can send to our senators and to our House members up at the federal level. So we would really appreciate that. That would mean a lot because we are the voices and they listen to our voices. And then to you, sir, Chief Harto has started MPD 2.0 and she has been very impactful in a very positive way. And she's working hand in hand with our Civil Rights Department with the new oversight committee, and she says, the first person she's holding accountable is herself. And so it starts at the top. She's leading, and that's happening.
Last five police chiefs to do the same thing, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. So, not okay. Yes.
And can I go to Arvon first?
One of your statements. Oh, my name is Arvon Fraser. One of your points really has me thinking. It was that, I mean, it's so obvious, but we don't think about it. Violence is learned, and I am sort of making the analogy because I believe that as a community and a country, we have to take on that question, the question of violence. And we've kind of done it with children. I'm old enough to remember you go into a supermarket, I don't know, 30 years ago, and you might see a parent kind of abusing the kid. We don't see that anymore. We have changed the culture about at least accepting kind of publicly child abuse. It seems to me we have to change the culture about guns. Look at the movies we go to and the TV we watch, and we all get a kind of vicarious pleasure out of this violence, right? I think we have to think about that, and we have to understand civil rights and civil liberties at the same time, but it's not just the family. It is the whole culture and the community. And kids who live in a community where gun violence is the norm, guns are going to be the norm. We got to think about this very hard.
Okay, we had one there.
Okay. We all live in communities. Some are affected more so to violence or gun violence than others. But at the same time, we all are affected in some way. And we're seeing this with the globalization, with technology. You see it instantaneously every second. And you all are here because you care. When I talk to Jeremy, you all are sitting here not because Sherm is just standing up here and talking about this. You are here because you care. And that tells me everything. here I am, an African American with a Native American, and look at the audience here, and you are here, and you all are here. You are here. That tells me everything. And change is coming, and we will make differences.
Do you still have your question? Introduce yourself.
Joyce Anderson. I wondered if the local media and the schools are helpful, useful, or helpful. Are the local media and the schools useful or helpful? Do you work with them?
And repeat the question.
Her question was, is the local media and schools helpful? But the schools, definitely, we're partnering with them with our school resource officers. We have Minneapolis police officers in our schools, and they're there as partners, working with the kids, working with the administrational leadership. It's been a wonderful partnership, and we have seen tremendous outcomes from that. As I said, with Bike Cops for Kids, with kids not just seeing the cop doing, a police officer doing school, but seeing that officer during the summer, and there's a relationship there. There's Officer Mike, there's Officer Sherm, there's Officer D6. They're running up to these officers, and they're happy to see them. When it's starting from here, by the time they're in high school, junior high school and high school, the seed has been set. And now it's been just very, very positive. And with the media, you know, the media, ma'am, the media is covering, from a media standpoint, they're covering the issue. As far as I know, I can't, and that can go either way.
Let's see, Jeremy, you pick.
Let's swing over this side of the room if we can't get some new questions, new voices.
Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Katie Fournier. The federal legislation that Senators Manchin and Toomey are proposing doesn't seem nearly strong enough to me. And I know there's politics, but and both of them are known gun advocates. So they're putting together a sort of a shadow thing that's going to make us think the Senate, the federal government did something. In my opinion.
Respond or another.
I think that the one of the most positive things out of that is that we're going to hear we got it to the floor. You know, the debate is going to happen, and that's you know, the Senate voted on that, so they came to an agreement to do that. And as far as what's going to happen with their bill or their amendments, man, we just have to we're going to have to wait and see.
Jeremy, your call. Your call.
Let's say some people who haven't asked questions.
And introduce yourself.
My name is Mark Scipione. I think, to some extent, I think we need to keep in mind the idea of returning to the source. The Second Amendment means what the U.S. Supreme Court says it means. The meaning has changed over time. Precedent, of course, is malleable. And the meaning will change again. And so I think, bottom line, we need a better Supreme Court than we have.